Please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome for Mr. Timothy J. Manopoulos and John Gallagher. And at this time, I understand Tim would like to make some opening remarks before I turn it over to John. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick, for the very kind introduction. I want to thank the Detroit Economic Club for inviting me to be here today. It's great to be here in Detroit. I read that back in 1934, the club's founder, Alan Crow, had the idea that if you gathered a lot of smart people in one room, you could find a way out of the Great Depression. So that means that we have a lot in common, Detroit and Fannie Mae, because Fannie Mae is a product of the Great Depression. Fannie Mae was thought of as one of the ways out of the Great Depression. The world's obviously changed a lot in 80 years, but the fundamental challenge of providing housing options that are affordable to working families is one that is as urgent as ever, perhaps even more so. At Fannie Mae, we think about this challenge all the time, and we are always looking for new ways to address it. As you probably know, Fannie Mae is a housing finance company. We don't make loans directly to consumers, but we operate instead in the secondary mortgage market. We buy loans from our lender customers, and we package them into mortgage-backed securities. This helps ensure that lenders have the funding for mortgages to make mortgages to homeowners and to owners of multifamily rental properties. I want to thank so many of our customers who are here with us here today in Detroit. We really enjoy the great partnership that we have with them. Our business strategy at Fannie Mae is centered on helping our customers succeed. One of the ways that we do this is by providing innovative solutions to help our customers wring time and cost out of the mortgage process. For most of you who have been through the mortgage process, you know that until recently, applying for and closing on a mortgage looked and felt a lot like the way it did in the 1990s. Thankfully, that is rapidly changing. For example, we're providing tools that allow lenders to quickly and easily verify a borrower's income, assets, and employment. Today, the time from loan application to loan closing can take weeks, if not months. We're aiming to bring that down to a matter of days. The application process also continues to rely heavily on paper, even though we operate in a digital age. We believe that we can achieve a fully digitized mortgage experience that is faster, simpler, and safer for all concerned. By giving lenders more reliable information, these innovations also help expand access to credit for more creditworthy borrowers. And by cutting costs from the process, we're helping lenders to better serve lower income borrowers. This is a key benefit because housing affordability is a growing challenge for our country. America's economic expansion is now in its eighth year. Housing is also recovering, thank goodness. Delinquency rates are on a path to return to historical norms. Foreclosure starts are back to pre-crisis levels. That's all good news, and we're grateful for that. But we all know that some parts of the country have recovered faster than other parts, and many families of modest means continue to struggle, especially when it comes to housing. Since 2011, home prices have increased an average of 5.5% per year, but median household income is up an average of only 1% a year. About one-third of U.S. households are what we call cost-burdened. That means they pay more than 30% of their income for housing. The supply of affordable housing is a very big part of this problem. Since the onset of the housing bust, more than 1 million starter homes have been lost. Between 2012 and 2015, the most affordable one-third of homes rose 38% in price, and the inventory dropped by 39%. Inventory for the most expensive homes, on the other hand, has gone up. As you all probably recognize, Detroit has a unique set of housing challenges. The city, of course, has lost population, and the Detroit Land Bank now holds 95,000 properties that are essentially off the market. At the same time, the supply of habitable, affordable homes on the market is tighter than it is nationally. For homes priced under $300,000, Detroit has only a 2-month supply compared to a 9-month supply for homes above $500,000. Speculators have driven up prices, and as a result, owning a home in Detroit is now 30% more expensive than renting. For the country as a whole, owning a home is about 10% less expensive than renting. Creating more starter homes is really beyond Fannie Mae's job description. We're in housing finance, we don't build homes. But in financing homes, we do play a vital role, and we can bring together partners from different parts of the housing economy to tackle tough challenges. And where we think we can make a difference, we truly have a responsibility to try. One of the lessons of the housing crisis is that when you're confronted with an unprecedented problem, you need to try new solutions. So let me just share one example that we experienced recently. As the crisis accelerated, we worked with our own servicers and partners across the country to help struggling homeowners. We spent countless hours writing policies for deciding which homeowners should receive a mortgage modification to lower their monthly payment. But the guidelines were highly complex, they required lots of documentation from homeowners, and were hard for our servicers to implement. We felt like we were always 2 steps behind the crisis. So after a bit, we tried a simpler approach. We developed a streamlined modification that required almost no documentation from homeowners. We offered it to every eligible homeowner, and if they made the new payment for 3 months in a row, we made the modification permanent. By thinking more creatively, by making things simpler and more efficient, we were able to help more homeowners. Since 2009, we've made 2 million loan modifications and other workouts and 4.6 million Refi Plus refinancings. We need to bring the same type of thinking, the same openness to new ideas to today's housing challenges like the ones facing Detroit. A healthy economy and a healthy housing market are part of the same chain of economic relationships. Jobs provide incomes which support mortgage and rent payments. More affordable housing draws more employers and jobs to the market. And the same is true with good transportation, schools, and healthcare. In too many cities, too many links in this chain are broken. We want to work with local partners to try new approaches for repairing those links. We're taking a test and learn approach, and we're eager to work with partners in Detroit who are willing to test and learn along with us. We want to ensure that the solutions that we offer have the greatest possible impact on Detroit's affordable housing challenges, which are many. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but let me share some of the questions that we're looking at. For example, we're asking, is it possible to offer financing that gives new homeowners an incentive to renovate existing homes in transitional neighborhoods on the cusp of recovery? If we did, how would we share that risk with our own lender partners? What role could the city play? And what role could home builders and renovators play? We're also looking at whether it's possible to partner with investors, the city, and our lenders to offer creative rent-to-own financing for renovated homes. We don't know if these are all the right questions, but we want to start a conversation with you to identify ideas that work for Detroit. And as we do, we want to take what we learn in Detroit and apply it in other communities with similar challenges. No one person, no one company, no one city can solve all of our nation's housing challenges. All require partnership. Partnerships help us achieve more together than we can working alone. Fannie Mae seeks to be America's most valued housing partner. We want to always be there for our customers and for all our partners in communities like Detroit that are on the road to recovery. Thank you very much. I look forward to engaging with you a little bit later on in the program.
Well, Tim, thank you and welcome to Detroit.
Thank you, it's good to be here.
Sure, as you mentioned, you have a lot of your client customers here, lenders, bankers, and so on. So we'll start with a question for them. You just mentioned digitization of the underwriting process and some of the innovative things you do. And can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So You know, we live in a different world today. All of us have come to experience things like Google and Amazon, and I think that's really started to define what we think of as an acceptable consumer experience. And unfortunately, in the mortgage business, we've kind of been a little bit Luddites, I think, for a long time. Some of that's understandable. You know, in the years leading up to the crisis in the 2000s, mortgage lenders made a lot of money by doing things the old-fashioned way. Then the crisis hit, and we were all overwhelmed with trying to deal with all of the loss mitigation efforts that we had underway. And then there was a wave of regulation that changed a lot of the basic rules of mortgage lending. And so we really took a good 10, 15 years there and put innovation to one side. But what we're experiencing at Fannie Mae is that we think the industry is really ready to embrace innovation and embrace a digital mortgage process. So some of our efforts have been to try to create a consumer experience where people can provide the information that is necessary for a good underwriting experience, to be able to verify their employment status, verify their income, verify their assets, and determine the value of the property that they want to finance. We can do all that digitally today, and we've built the tools, we've deployed them to our lenders, and they're making those available to their customers, to borrowers. I think it's going to revolutionize the mortgage business. It will take time, but there's no reason why consumers shouldn't have the same quality consumer experience that they have in so many other aspects of their life, why they can't have that in the mortgage business. And the great thing about it is it doesn't have to happen at the expense of safety or with a big increase in risk. If anything, actually, what this is going to allow us to do is inspect what's in the loans that get delivered to us before those loans are even closed. That's the way we're operating today. We used to accept a lot of the loans that lenders delivered to us with a promise that they conform to our standards, but we weren't able to actually go and inspect those before they got delivered. Today, through these digital processes, we can really do that, and it's going to help speed up the process. It's going to make it more efficient, and hopefully those savings that come from that efficiency will get passed on to consumers, and it will make access to credit that much more affordable.
Good. All right, well, let's follow up a little bit. One of the students upstairs asked a great question. How do you balance promoting affordability and also safety at the same time so we don't get in the same situation we were?
Right. So this is a really hard lesson that we learned through the crisis, that there's really no point in putting people into homes that they cannot sustainably afford. You know, we don't do any family a favor by giving them a mortgage that they can't make the payments on as time goes by. There are always going to be events to occur to households that are unforeseen, okay? A wage earner could die, they could lose their job, there's a divorce, you know, people get sick. Those are things that we can manage, that we understand that will happen. We can't guarantee against those things, but we should know that when we actually extend mortgage credit to people, that there's a very high likelihood that they'll actually be able to afford that mortgage going forward. So one of the things we did in the wake of the crisis was redefine our own credit box, our own underwriting standards, and we have not changed those since 2009 when we put those new standards in place. Those are the right standards. What we have attempted to do, however, is to create innovations that will allow people's true creditworthiness to be able to come through. We've tried to adopt changes that allow people to rely on trended credit data so you can actually see how consumers actually pay their bills over time through a digital process. We're interested in making sure that people are able to count all of their income in the new gig economy, which many people are using to kind of cobble together their income. Those are the kind of innovations that we need to do, but it can't come with the sacrifice of fundamental good underwriting.
Okay. Affordability is often pitched as simply a credit risk for the borrower, but there's a lot more to homeownership than simply your credit score, right? So how do we promote affordability beyond just the credit score sort of thing?
Right. So I think one of the things that's critical to do is really around borrower education. You know, we've done studies that indicate that most borrowers really don't have really any good idea about what it takes to get a mortgage loan. They don't understand how good their credit needs to be, and they don't understand how much they need to put down on a down payment. Most people think that you have to have at least 20% down on a house. That's not true. There are a lot of opportunities to put down less than that. And most people think you need to have a very high credit score in order to get mortgage credit. That's also not true. You need to have good credit, but you don't have to have pristine credit. So one important thing is just educating people about what is available out there. And I think there are a lot of people in communities that have actually backed away from even applying for credit because they don't want to go through the embarrassment of seeking a mortgage loan and getting turned down. So one of the things we need to do is just educate people about that. So that's critical. You know, I think that there are, you know, other things obviously that we also clearly need to do. We need to create more housing for people. We need to increase the availability of starter homes. And one of the challenges is that the cost of producing lower income housing has gone up exponentially. There are lots and lots of factors that are at play for that, but we need to tackle those issues as well.
Okay. In Detroit and a lot of cities, we're really interested in questions of income inequality, opportunity for all. Where does housing affordability play into those kind of issues?
So, you know, there's no doubt that for many Americans, although this has become a little suspect, I think, in the wake of the crisis, but there's no doubt from our point of view that for many Americans that buying a home is one of the very few ways they can actually make a leveraged investment. It's one of the very few ways that they can actually create even a modest amount of wealth. So, you know, if you can put down 5%, 10% and buy a home, you're going to provide something that your family needs anyway, which is housing, and you can get all of the appreciation, but we want to make sure we do that in a sustainable way. So the key to reducing income inequality, I think, is to create choices for people, right? We don't want to put everybody into a home. Not everyone can afford a home. Not everyone should be in a home that they own, but everyone should have access to affordable housing. So we want to create as much access to home ownership as possible, but by the same token, we also want to create access to good affordable rental housing, which is another big part of our business.
Right. Well, let's explore that. Talk about the rental housing component of what Fannie Mae does and how that plays into questions of affordability and opportunity.
So so most people know us as the people who provide mortgage credit for home ownership, and that's the bulk of our business, but we also support rental markets in two important ways. One is we are one of the largest providers of what's called multifamily apartment financing. So apartment buildings around the country, we provide, you know, we have a $200 billion book of business where we finance properties all over the country. 90% of what we finance is affordable to families that make 120% of area median income or below. So this is truly workforce housing. Think about it as teachers, firefighters, you know, people who are regular people who work for a living. That's what we're focused on doing, and we do this in big cities, but we also do it in lots of other communities around the country. So in many what are thought of as secondary or tertiary markets, you know, smaller cities and rural markets. So that's a big part of what we do. And another big part of what we do in the rental space is we finance single family home rentals. Most of those properties are owned by mom and pop owners. It might be somebody who owned a home and then they traded up to their bigger, a little bit bigger home, but they kept their first home and they rented out. This provides an enormous amount of affordable rental housing in the country. Actually, over one half of all the rental housing in the United States is single family rental. It's not apartment buildings. So while there's this idea that every millennial wants to move to a big city and live in an apartment, all of our studies show that millennials actually have a preference for single family homes. That's where they grew up, that's where they want to live, and many of them get introduced to that by renting houses.
Yeah. Are we over the foreclosure crisis and the Great Recession, or are you still seeing, you know, ripple effects even 10 years later?
There's clearly still ripple effects. You know, what I'd say is the vast majority of the loans that we have on our books today are loans that we have acquired after 2009. The performance of those loans is extraordinarily high. Delinquency rates are at all-time lows. The loans that continue to generate serious delinquency for us are still loans that were originated before 2009. So there's still a legacy effect, and while many families have gotten over the hump, they've seen the equity return in their homes. They've seen their home prices appreciate with the recovery of housing markets. There's still plenty of families that are still struggling with homes that they bought before 2009. I think the other collateral effect is that there's still a reluctance, I think, for some lenders to extend to credit to the full scope of our credit box. So that's been loosening somewhat gradually, evolutionarily over time, but that's still an ongoing effect. And I think the other effect is that it has caused a lot of people to just choose to live in a way where they're not either entering the housing market or they're not trading up to the next home. We actually have plenty of first-time home buyers in the United States today. What we don't have are trade-up buyers. That's the real problem. People are not moving out of those starter homes to the next level up as they might have 10 or 15 years ago. And so there's very little supply available to people who need to move into starter homes as their first home. There's very little of that on the market, and those prices, as I mentioned earlier, are going up exponentially faster.
So the people who have a starter home are staying in them?
They're staying in those homes.
Yeah, okay. Well, the consequences of this long term, if there's a lack of affordable housing, what does that mean for the individuals and also for the nation?
Well, I think for the individuals, it means that many people are forced to rely on rental housing. Now, there's nothing wrong with rental housing. As I say, a big part of our business is making it available. But the challenge is that the rental market, rents are rising even faster than home prices. Rents are rising faster than wages. So many people are really in a bind. Not only are they paying more for their rent than they were the year before that, but they're unable to save for a down payment. So they're kind of stuck. They're almost frozen out of the housing market. That's a big challenge for those individuals. And I think the challenge for the nation and for our economy is that housing is like 20% of the national economy. In past recessions, as we've come out of them, housing has typically led the recovery. That's not been true. Housing has recovered, but the housing recovery has not led the recovery coming out of the recession. And as a result, we don't see as much economic growth as we would in the past. For a number of years now, we've seen only a 2% increase in GDP on an annual basis. Historically, the United States has had 3% GDP growth over time. And clearly one of the things that our policymakers in Washington are focused on is how to stimulate that growth. Doing that without stimulating housing, I think, will be very difficult, because it's not just people buying homes. There are a lot of jobs involved in building those homes, renovating those homes, building furniture and appliances to equip those homes. It's a very big part of our national economy, and so that's a big challenge. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing fairly anemic growth in terms of GDP.
Yeah. For two or three generations, owning a house has been a way to build wealth in America, especially generational wealth that you can pass on. Is that still the case?
I think it is still the case. For most Americans, it's the only investment opportunity where they can put a relatively modest amount down and see potentially substantial appreciation. I know in my own family, I look at my parents and my brothers and my sister, all of whom, you know, my father was a blue-collar worker, my father was a UAW member, one of my brothers is a truck driver for Walmart, my other brother is an auto mechanic, and my sister's a paralegal. The way they've created any sense of wealth, and I'm not talking about enormous amounts of money, is by buying a home and seeing appreciation on it. That's been a tried and true method for America for a long time. I think the crisis put a lot of that into doubt and made people very cautious about it. So I think it's a big challenge. We've got to kind of reinstill confidence in housing markets, I think, for people to come back into that market. There is some good news out there. You know, we have this millennial generation, the largest generation in American history, bigger than the baby boomer generation. You know, lots of people said those folks are never going to want to own a house. They just want to go live in their parents' basement. Many of us as parents, we've experienced that. Or they want to go live in an apartment, someplace in a big city. What we have always understood from our own surveys of millennials is that they desire to live in homes that they own in the same way as prior generations. The real question is, were they actually going to be able to go execute on that desire? What we're seeing is that that's starting to happen. That's good. That will continue to drive housing growth, but it's also going to put more pressure on prices, especially for low to moderate income people who are the folks who are not going to be able to take advantage of it. I think actually one of the great tragedies of the crisis is that for communities of color, much of their wealth was in home equity. Much of that wealth has been lost. And unfortunately, when prices drop considerably, those were not the people who were able to come back into the market and buy homes. And now that prices have risen, it may be beyond their ability to do that. So there's been a huge loss of wealth in communities of color that affects lots of areas, but I would imagine places like Detroit. In a profound way.
Yeah, very much. Let me do a little by the numbers on Fannie Mae, either scale, the scope, employees, size of your portfolio, slice of the mortgage market.
Yeah, so Fannie Mae is a big institution. We're one of the largest financial institutions in the world by asset size. We have a balance sheet of $3.2 trillion made up of the loans that we originate and that we acquire and guarantee. About $3 trillion of that is in the single family home ownership side. About $200 billion of that is on the multifamily financing side. We have about roughly 7,500 employees, so there's a lot of scale there. You know, only 7,500 employees for a business of that size. We have been reporting historically profits, net income after taxes, of about $2.5 to $3 billion a quarter. And as was mentioned earlier, given our arrangement with the government as a result of the investment the government made in our company after the crisis, we send our profits to the government, except for a little bit of retained earnings we're allowed to keep as a capital buffer. We send our profits to the Treasury every quarter. So as of the end of this December, we will have sent about $165 billion to the Treasury. We took $116 billion in aid from the government, so all of us as taxpayers should be pleased with that result. Many people thought that could never occur. Detroit's a place that understands that other institutions have been bailed out, and the government's return on some of those was good and some were not so good. The return on the government's investment in the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I think will end up being a very good result.
Good. Let me just ask, if somebody wants to become one of those 7,000 employees, they would think you got to be a finance nerd like you. You know, you must have been an MBA. No,
not no, true. No, I'm a recovering lawyer, but before that, I was a recovering English major. I was telling the students upstairs that I'm still a believer in liberal arts education. I have a 4-year degree in English and ended up going to law school because I happened to take one law course as an undergraduate. Ended up in finance. I've never taken an economics class. I've never taken an accounting class. I've visited the Harvard Business School and I've been to the MIT Sloan School of Business Management, but I'm not a business guy. And I think I certainly rely on other people to do some of the financial analysis around the company. But I do sometimes think that we're doing a disservice to some of our young people in telling them that they need to go learn a very specific trade or task. I think learning how to read, write, and think critically is really an important key to success.
Who's your favorite writer?
Who's my favorite writer? My favorite writer is James Agee. James Agee wrote a book called Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. I'm also a big fan of black and white photography, and Agee wrote this book about Hale County, Alabama, about sharecropper families in Hale County, Alabama in the Great Depression. And it was really originally started as a magazine story, and he went to Hale County, which is in West Alabama in the Black Belt of Alabama, with a guy named Walker Evans. Walker Evans is one of the great American photographers, and if you saw these photographs, you'd recognize them. They're quite iconic. And actually, I'm not giving this answer because I was just there last week, but I was in Hale County, Alabama last week, visiting there to try to figure out how can we solve some of the challenges around affordable housing in rural communities. It's a big challenge here in Detroit, but if you go to Hale County, Alabama, it's 50 miles to the closest interstate highway. It's 30 miles to the closest Walmart, okay? There's very little economic development there. And so one of the things we were looking at is these homes that have been designed by the architecture school at Auburn University, they for years they've been focused on how could they design homes that could be built for $20,000. And these are not trailer homes. These are, you know, these are homes that are actually built on site. One of the things they want to do is help create a labor market there as well. And so we went down there to try to explore all that. So that's a long answer to your question, but my favorite author is James Agee. If you've never read Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, for an English major like me, there's one chapter in the book that's just about describing a room in one of these sharecropper homes. It goes on for 10 or 15 pages. It's exquisite. It's truly exquisite.
Okay, good.
You would appreciate it. I'm sure you would.
I'm sure I would, yeah. I know. Well, I know the book very well. Yeah. Anyway, let me just repeat a question one of the students asked. What keeps you up at night?
So there are not many things that keep me up at night, but one of the things it does is this whole issue around cybersecurity. As you can imagine, we have records relating to 18 million mortgage loans in our company. So we have access to a lot of personal information for millions of American families. Like every other major institution, whether it's a government institution or private sector institution, we're very concerned about maintaining the confidentiality and privacy of all that information. So we spend a lot of energy on that. And unfortunately, there are a lot of bad people out there working very hard to try to breach the cyber walls of major institutions. And they only have to be successful once. We have to be successful every time in stopping them, but they only have to be successful once in order to kind of break through that. So that's a big concern.
Okay, good. Why don't we bring Rick back up and we'll do some questions from you all.
Okay, well, I've been keeping tabs here, and the number one question has to do with, unfortunately, just the weather we've been having. And the question had to do with Fannie Mae and recent hurricanes in Florida, Puerto Rico, and also in Houston, what effect that's had on Fannie Mae. And a kind of a corollary question was, is that going to change any of the process that you currently have now?
So the hurricanes obviously were devastating events for the communities that were affected. Obviously, Houston and the Gulf states were hit hard. Florida and all of Florida really hit very hard. But I'd say that the worst situation clearly is in Puerto Rico. We have about about 100,000 loans in Puerto Rico. If you saw our financial results in the last few weeks, you saw that we took a very substantial addition to our loan loss reserve to cover expected losses there. I think one of the good news stories here is that many of the lessons that we learned through the financial crisis, we've been able to apply in these situations. So we didn't wait for people to reach out to us. We put out the word that said, if you've been affected by the hurricane and you need to suspend making your mortgage payments for a couple of months, 3 months, you can go ahead and do that. We've told all our servicers, people are free to do that. And then if they need an extension beyond that, or they need some other form of help, such as a loan modification, we now have our streamlined modifications that we can put in place very quickly without paperwork. So I think the lessons that we've learned through the financial crisis, we're applying in these circumstances. But I do worry about places like Puerto Rico. The economies in places like Houston and the rest of the affected areas in the Gulf State and in Florida, those economies are actually pretty resilient. A place like Puerto Rico had a very challenging economy even before the hurricane. It had been losing population for a significant period of time. And now with the devastating effect of the hurricane there, there's a big migration of people out of Puerto Rico. You all know the effects of that. That's happened in places like Detroit. And the real question is, will those people leave permanently or will they come back and rejoin that economy? So it's very difficult to predict what the results are of these events. Sometimes it creates opportunity for huge capital investment, but that often takes time. And so it's very unclear what the outcome is going to be.
Okay. We have a number of questions, and really some of the new growth in Detroit has to do with startups and self-employed. So I'm bundling these questions, Tim, a little bit here, but is there any way to start having maybe some integration with, say, I know this is a four-letter word, with Internal Revenue Service on income verification, or the more streamlining, if you will, of the self-employed?
Yes. So that's actually been one of the things we've been very focused on. We already have ways of interfacing digitally with the IRS around income verification. But the reality is that many people, you know, historically, mortgage lenders, the easiest borrower to underwrite is one who has a 40-hour week job, gets a W-2, they've got their pay stub, you're always asked to produce your pay stub, you know, and for people who are in that circumstance, that's relatively easy to do. The challenge is that in the new gig economy, there are people who are cobbling together lots of different ways to make money, right? They might rent a room in their house. They might be an Uber driver. They might, you know, work part of their time as a consultant, or they might have a business they have on the side. So one of the things that we've been trying to do is to focus in on actually getting past trying to verify each one of those things and get to a point where we can go to a single source of validation, where we can look at what's happening in people's bank accounts. Most people take all the money they earn and they put it into their bank account, okay? So if you could digitally see what's going into their bank account with their permission, and you could see what's going out of their bank account, again, with their permission, what expenses they have, you'd actually be able to see what their net income is and make a decision about whether they're a good credit in terms of getting a mortgage loan. We want to be able to actually give people credit for paying years of rent. The fact that they paid years of rent should mean that they're likely to make their mortgage payment, especially if their mortgage payment is no higher than what their rent payment has been. So that's what we're ultimately trying to get to, is a way of digitally looking at the financial activity in people's lives, whatever the source of their income, whatever their expenses are, and be able to determine what their net income is for underwriting purposes.
Next one's might take you back about 10 years, but I think it's probably a good question, and that is that roughly about 62% is about the level of home ownership. Do you believe that if that gets up to, say, in the 70s, that that's going to cause a problem like what we had 10 years ago?
Well, if we got there because we extended credit to people who really shouldn't be owning homes, that they were just speculating or, you know, were duped into buying homes they shouldn't have bought or getting credit they shouldn't have had, yes, that will be a problem if that's what happens. I am confident, given the changes in regulation and oversight of the housing market, that that's not likely to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the bigger challenge is that we actually don't reverse the decline in home ownership and that we continue to see a further decline. Our impression is that home ownership rates have kind of settled out now at the number you mentioned, 62%. The question is whether they'll start to grow again. That should be a slow, steady, gradual growth. If we saw that, that would tell us that the economy is growing, people's income is going up, and that they're investing in their communities. Those would all be good things. Those would all be good things. But if we got there through smoke and mirrors, the kind of the way we did leading up to the financial crisis, it would be a tragedy, actually, if we did that again. I certainly don't expect that to happen again in my professional life.
Since we're, in addition to Thanksgiving, it's also the time of year for looking at a couple of tax plans. Can you comment on the House and the Senate bills in terms of tax plans and what effect that might have on Fannie Mae and the housing market?
So we do not, we don't lobby. We don't go weigh in on legislative proposals before the Congress. Sometimes members of Congress will ask us for technical advice on certain things and we'll go down and we'll chat with them about that and give them our views. But that's all very fact-based. We're not out there lobbying for any particular results. So I don't want anybody to take anything I say here today as my expressing Fannie Mae's view or even my own personal point of view about any of the current tax proposals. I do think that there's obviously a lot that's being talked about that could affect housing markets. There's some things and things that could affect Fannie Mae. There's one matter in particular that could affect Fannie Mae, and we've been disclosing this now for quite a long time, which is that if corporate tax rates are reduced from their current levels to some substantially lower levels, which seems highly likely if tax reform is enacted, then we, like every other company in America, would have to write down what are called deferred tax assets. These are assets that we hold on our book that basically quantify the value of future tax benefits, but we have to monetize those. If tax rates come down, corporate tax rates come down, the value of those tax assets goes down, and we would have to write those down in the quarter in which the tax reform was enacted. So if that happens, we'll have a significant loss in that quarter. Now, one of the strange things about our arrangement with the government is that, unlike virtually every other financial institution in the country, where people have been required to carry more and more capital, at Fannie Mae and our sibling, Freddie Mac, we've not been able to retain any capital. Okay, so we were allowed to keep about $3 billion of retained earnings going back a few years, and that number declined by $600 million every year until it gets to zero. And it gets to zero on January 1 of 2018 in about 6 weeks. So if we have a loss in a quarter, if it's bigger than, you know, if the amount of the write-down is bigger than what our earnings would be in that quarter, we'll have a loss, and that would mean we would have to request money from the Treasury to bring our balance sheet back to zero. So if that happens, I hope people won't think that that's another bailout of Fannie Mae, because we've been warning people for some time that this could happen. So that's one potential effect of the tax reform. Others would be, you know, what happens to the mortgage interest deduction, what happens to the deductibility of state and local taxes. Those things could all affect housing markets. The effects of those are complicated, however. Very difficult to generalize about that. It's likely to have some effect on higher end markets, not the highest end markets where people are fairly insensitive to things like mortgage interest deduction or state and local tax deductibility. But for affluent communities, you might see a hit to home prices, because some of those factors will negatively affect that. On the other hand, it might actually make the value of more modestly priced homes go up, as some of those consumers who otherwise would have gone for something that was a more expensive home kind of look at homes that are less expensive. So it's a complicated story, and you know, if I could predict the future, I'd be worth a lot more money than I am. So.
Well, it's normally the tradition of Detroit Economic Club, some of the toughest questions come from the students. This one probably is no exception, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but if you forecast out 3, 5, 7 years in the digital age, do you foresee maybe disintermediation, that's my word, not the students, of people being able to access the ultimate buyer, i.e. Fannie Mae or Freddie, and kind of cut out, this is sacrilegious, but the banks or the intermediaries, if you will?
I don't see that happening. We, by charter, are not permitted to make loans to consumers. We're not allowed to extend credit directly to any borrower. We are required to work through mortgage lenders. And those are our partners. That's the way we think about them. That's the way we will think about them 3, 5, 7 years from now. So I do think there's huge opportunity for disruption of mortgage markets in terms of making a much more efficient, faster, safer system than it's been historically, but I don't see disintermediation of mortgage lenders. I don't see that happening. Now, it might be that there'll be the rise of certain kinds of mortgage lenders in the future that are different than the mortgage lenders we have today. You see that already. You see that with companies that are looking to create a completely digital experience, not the experience you'd have with your traditional lender. That might happen. So you might have a different sort of mortgage originator, but it's not going to be Fannie Mae out there originating mortgages.
I know you're going to be touring around Detroit this afternoon, and I'm not sure if you're going to see this or not, but there's been a lot of apartments that are being built in what's called micro living spaces. Can you kind of share with the audience, as your last question, I guess, just thoughts on that from the multifamily standpoint?
You know, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. I think what you're seeing, it's another area of potential innovation where folks are looking at how do you create affordable housing for people by changing what the configuration is of some of these arrangements. I've talked with companies that are creating essentially micro units that can be put into people's existing single family homes to turn one bedroom into two, and they're essentially become little pods. I've talked to other kinds of people come with different sorts of ideas. I think what we're seeing is that there's been this unleashing of people's imaginations of how to solve these problems. And I don't think that we should assume that the traditional ways of doing things are going to hold. And I also don't think we should assume that the traditional way of doing things were the best ways of doing things. I think there are probably a lot of people who would trade square footage for just knowing they had a good, decent place to live. And I think we all need to embark on this process of exploration and imagination. So I'm whenever I go to places like Silicon Valley and talk to folks out there, I am overwhelmed by the creativity and the imagination, the proliferation of ideas. It's actually a really exciting time, not just in housing finance, but anything that's remotely technologically related.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Mayopoulos, I think Fannie Mae's in very good hands with you. Thanks for traveling to Detroit to be with us. Ladies and gentlemen, another round of applause for Mr. Mayopoulos, please. John Gallagher, outstanding job as moderator. We always enjoy reading you. I really particularly enjoyed your column yesterday. Thank you, and Sunday's Free Press. Rick DeVore, outstanding job as presiding officer. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, happy Thanksgiving to you and your families. This meeting is adjourned.